This is a CNA podcast.
This is The Heart of the Matter. I'm Jamie Ho. This week, we're talking about pets, dogs, and their place in HDB flats. And maybe we'll talk about cats too. But in any case, good news for fans of the Singapore Special. Under newly announced revised rules, HDB owners can now adopt larger, local, mixed-breed dogs. But some are asking, why not roll out increases in size limits across all dogs or even lift the ban on cat ownership in HDB flats? If we can expect to see more dogs in HDBs, how do we ensure responsible pet ownership? With me today to discuss these questions are Jaypal Singh Gill, he's the Executive Director of the SPCA, and Kelvin Ho, who's a veterinarian at Animal Veterinary Services, AVS. Welcome to the both of you. Thank you for being with me. So let me just get to the heart of the matter and these newly announced rules where dogs of a slightly bigger size are now allowed to be adopted and placed in HDB flats. Jaypal, give me your sense. How does this impact the overall universe of the pet sector here in Singapore? Obviously, this is meant to allow more dogs to be homed. There's something like 20% more, 25% more dogs eventually will be homed. Is this a good direction? And is this just a first step? What more do you think we can do here?
So thanks, Jamie, for having me on. We think that this change, this Project Adore height and weight change is really good news for Singapore Specials in Singapore. So we have a lot of dogs on the street that ideally, if we could bring them into homes, that would be much better for the animals involved. We have shelters as well that are filled with Singapore Specials, struggling to find homes because previously very few homes in Singapore were open to them. So with this change, we expect now that a majority of the dogs who live on the street and the majority of the dogs who are in shelters will now be eligible to live in a HDB flat. I mean, I think getting those animals off the street and out of shelters and into good homes is going to be a very good outcome for those animals.
Okay. But Kelvin, tell me what your take is. Honestly, where Singapore stands in terms of our overall ability to care for dogs and cats and pets in general, HDB flat or not, because you see problems once in a while in other types of homes and abodes as well. Right. So obviously, this one opens up the possibilities for HDB flats. But what other areas of improvement can we see in terms of pet welfare?
Well, I think firstly, I think just going back to Project Adore, you know, I think it's a reflection of our state of pet ownership in Singapore. So, I mean, Project Adore, it started out in 2012. It took us almost 8 years to implement this. It took us 8 years because we have been considering and reviewing the program very closely because we are aware that there are differing views out there, you know, of big dogs in the community. The responses to this program over the years has been positive. We have not received many feedback. And actually, it's very low, you know, like it's as low as 2%.
So, 2% what?
2% of the dogs that were rehomed under the Project Adore.
Okay.
And all of these feedback, you know, it's actually very minor. You know, we're talking about things like dog barking, letting your dog run in public places.
Yeah, precisely, yeah.
So these issues can actually be managed if owners are more responsible.
Yeah.
They have access to behavioral training, which we are very encouraged by the support of the animal welfare groups because they are there to provide training and also, you know, mediation. It took us 8 years and then we felt that, you know, it's finally time to increase. No, it's the baby step, but it's definitely significant.
You see, okay, step. So here, what's happened there is that now dogs which are 10% larger can be homed, right? Mm-hmm. So it goes back to the point, is it really a question about size? Why is size such a proxy for other issues, right? Because a small dog can be badly homed in a big house. A big dog can be well taken care of in a smaller home, right? So it's not as if it's not mutually exclusive. So what is your take on this, Jaypal, in that is there larger issues at play here where we're talking about pet welfare? And can we move away from pet size, perhaps, you think, one day?
Yeah. Absolutely. So for the size aspect and living in a flat, there's no real correlation in terms of for the animal's welfare. You can have a larger dog in a HDB flat or an apartment, for example. And if you do the right thing, you can fully secure the animal's welfare. So it's about how you look after the animal more than just the space.
My view too,
yeah. But of course, I think the size plays a part for the human more than the animal. So when Project Adore was first mooted by the SPCA and another animal welfare organization, ASD, in 2011, and then it came in 2012, what we were thinking then was that, and we wanted to start with the smaller local breeds because we didn't want people to have an aversive reaction and start suddenly seeing local breed dogs, mongrels, Singapore Specials, living in HDB flats if they were too large. We felt that if they were of a large size, some people may start to maybe have a little bit more fear, and they may not react to these animals so positively. So the thinking behind it was that, look, we will start off with a smaller size and then we will increase it from there. And so that people know that actually these dogs are no different from any other dog. It's all about the individual animal. It's about how the owner looks after that animal.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what Kelvin said before, and that's the positivity we have seen to the scheme. Very positive, very low complaint rate against these dogs because the owners, the animal welfare groups, everybody's doing the right thing in terms of rehoming the dogs there. So size is really not a big factor from that point of view. It's only for the people living.
Funnily enough, I mean, I'm owned by a dog. I won't say I'm a dog owner. And you know, you find sometimes the bigger dogs are calmer sometimes compared to the smaller, slightly more highly strung dogs, right? But in any case, when you see places like New York City, Manhattan, right? Everyone lives in very small apartments, but everyone has their dogs, small, tiny ones, really big ones as well. And you see them in Central Park quite regularly. And I always thought to myself, so these big dogs live in small apartments. But the thing is that obviously then they have very special needs in that they need to be walked much more often. In your sense, Kelvin, and in your interactions, do you think pet owners and especially dog owners are really prepared for the kind of things that come with smaller dogs versus larger dogs and responsibilities that come with it? Or is it sometimes, you know, they think they can get away with slightly less?
Well, I think as J-Paul has like aptly put it across, I think it doesn't really depend on the size. I think whether it's a big dog or a small dog, I mean, there are certain welfare needs that a dog needs, you know, exercising, you know, access to good quality food. So when the owner, you know, first decides to take up a dog as a pet, he or she has to be cognizant there's some commitment on his or her part, you know, taking the dog out on a walk and then assessing the behavior of the dog, because each dog is an individual with its own behavioral requirements. So, you know, there's no hard and fast rule to say, you know, what a dog actually needs. In general, they need like all this general welfare things, but you know, you just have to look at each dog separately and specifically.
Let's talk about the owners as well, because as you say, sometimes the issue is more the owner than the pet itself. Since I mentioned New York, I was just thinking about this. Do you see any peculiarities in terms of pet owners in Singapore versus other places which are more used to dogs perhaps, that somehow or other frames our view of how to take care of these dogs?
Sure. So one area we do see, and that is a concern from the animal welfare point of view, is that we see a lot of cases reported to us where dogs are being kept in cages or on leashes. And very often those are actually just quick fix solutions to a problem. For example, the animal is not well toilet trained. It's biting furniture, digging up the garden. And the response of the owner is to confine that animal to solve that problem without sufficient regard for their welfare versus what should be the right way, which would be taking the time and effort
to correct the behavior
in a humane way. Yeah, that's something we do see fairly commonly and something I think we need to be moving away from. I remember when I was a young inspector at the SPCA, it's my first job at the SPCA, and I was dealing with these cases, I would go to the ground, and many times when I encountered pet owners who were doing this with their dogs, so I would have a case where a dog is being caged up 23 to 23 and a half hours a day, literally just out for one run for 20 minutes. Sometimes not at all, but sometimes yes, out for one 20 minute run or half an hour run a day. And their responses will always be, yeah, but it's a dog. You know, they're almost shocked that I have a concern
about that
because they're like, it's a dog. Where do you think they belong? And then I get other responses like, yeah, but pet shops are selling cages. What are the cages for if they're not meant to cage a dog, for example? So I think that's a mindset issue. I think that's something that we need to look at carefully and change.
Have you heard that kind of or seen that kind of dynamic?
We do encounter cases where, you know, owners just do not have time to take care of dogs. And, you know, on some occasions they will approach us to say, you know, could we surrender, you know, because there's some behavioral or health issues. That's the point where we actually could advise owners, you know, there's these things you can do. You can approach trainers, you can talk to your vet. There just have to be more awareness among pet owners regarding all these things.
So I wonder sometimes whether or not there are other ways to strengthen the overall regulatory environment when it comes to pet ownership, because now you see the government trying to move the needle a little bit, but you still see a few that are a bit incoherent, I would say, at this juncture. Because on the one hand, you have the pet shops, and you would argue, I think, that it's quite easy to get a dog or a cat from a pet shop. Then you have the NGOs and the rehomers who are much more stringent. They have stronger requirements. They make sure you know what you're doing. They'll come and visit. They'll come and counsel. So you have these two universes, and if I were a pet owner for the first time, I say, why is it so much of a hassle if I just wanted to adopt a cat or a dog? then you default to going to a pet shop. And that's the worst case outcome, I would imagine, right? So where is the middle that we can find? And is that always government regulation? What's your take, J-Pal?
Sure. So, no, I definitely don't think that this entire problem can be solved with government regulation for sure. So if you look at the dichotomy, and yes, I agree, there is a difference in a pet shop. You go in there, there's a different way you obtain your pet and a difference in the shelter. What I would say is that I don't think it should be so easy to obtain a pet. That you walk into a shop or any space and you walk out half an hour later with an animal and you are not prepared, you did not know what you're getting yourself into. And actually that causes a lot of the downstream problems that we subsequently see in terms of nuisance, barking cases, other issues, what I talked about in terms of welfare issues like caging and chaining. You get those things happening a lot of the times because somebody goes in getting a pet without being fully prepared. So if you look at, for example, what the shelters do, there's a counselling process. You ensure the person is ready for the commitment. You explain to them the cost, the time, the energy that's going to be required for that particular animal, that particular species. And they go in with eyes more open than they would have if they had maybe gone to a pet shop. I do think we need to look at how pet shops are running their sales of animals. We've done undercover surveys in pet shops before. Yeah. What we have found, for example, you know, we went in with a young couple looking to try to get a puppy, and the couple informed the salesperson that they were working long hours. They were only back at 10, 11 o'clock at night. They would leave in the morning because they were busy young professionals. Yeah. And the pet shop owner's advice was then just get a cage as well so that you can put the dog in there, because if you...
Goodness, okay.
The dog, your house is going to be messed up if you... away for so long. There was no further advice about getting a puppy, 2-month-old puppy, if you're out of the house for the most of the day. And so that's quite concerning if that sort of thing is still going on.
Yeah, because you see in some other countries, it's quite clear, you can't even buy a dog from a pet shop. It's either from a very registered breeder who knows who they are selling it to and obviously breed ethically, or you adopt. And there's no in-between. Is that a realistic goal, you think, Kelvin?
Well, I think on one hand, you know, definitely regulations play a role, you know, in terms of enforcing animal welfare standards. But pet ownership is really a social responsibility. Each pet owner has a role to play. The community has a role to play. We do emphasize a lot on public education to reach out to owners on responsible pet ownership. And also when there are feedbacks, you actually reach out to them to, you know, advise on how you could you actually reduce the barking, how you should leash your dogs, and then, you know, where necessary, we take the heavy stance of like using enforcement actions. On the other hand, you know, we're talking about pet shops, right? Well, currently pet shops, they do have some screening process where they actually screen prospective pet owners before buying any pets, you know, just to make sure they don't buy on impulse. Yeah. So I think it's a gradual step. I mean, it's so akin to sort of a counselling.
Yeah, because I mean, to be fair, sometimes I feel sorry for the pet shops as well, because to be frank, they are there to make a sale,
right?
They're not going to be there to say, actually, I don't want you. I don't want this. You don't look like you're very good owner. Go away. Because you're in a business, it's not like they're going to do that. So I wonder whether someday there's going to be far greater enforcement or at least regulation as far as that is concerned. But I want to talk about also, since we started this talking about HDB flats, the issue about cats. And this is something that MP Louis Ng has pushed, and most recently he did as well, as to ask if, let's say, all pet owners are equally good or equally bad when it comes to pet welfare. What is the difference between a dog and a cat? If I am a responsible pet owner, why is it that I can't own a cat in a HDB flat versus a dog? I mean, I don't think people understand. And to be frank, I'm also sometimes still confused as to why the differentiation between a cat and a dog. But J-Pal, do you have a sense about this? And what's the SPCA's take on this?
Sure. The SPCA for a few decades now have been asking for the ban to be lifted. So we are absolutely clear in our stance on this issue. We have not changed our position. And as the years go by, we are even more certain of this position that the ban has no positive outcomes and only negative outcomes. So if the argument is that the ban is stopping people from keeping cats in HDB flats, then we all know that's not true. I haven't met a single person in my experience so far who is not keeping a cat because of the ban. And we all know countless people who are keeping cats. So that ban is not actually having an effect on the keeping of cats.
Because it's not really enforced as well. I think it's very light-handed.
And it's not enforced. So then you look at maybe the other benefit, that the argument could be that the benefit of keeping that ban is that, oh, I can take enforcement action if there's nuisance. But that's not, again, I think a valid argument, because you can take enforcement action action whether the cats are allowed or not. If you allow cats and there's a nuisance issue,
you can still
take an enforcement action. Yeah. You don't need a ban to take enforcement action. So there's no positive outcome from the ban. Let's look at the negative outcomes of the ban. Number one, I can completely sympathize with the angst of, you know, those living in HDB flats who want to keep cats, who are keeping cats, who feel that they are doing something illegitimately, always have to look over their shoulder, worried if they have a dispute with their neighbor will take revenge by complaining against them. We have seen that thing happening before. It's quite unfortunate. It's rare, thankfully, but we have seen that happening before. So number one, you understand their angst. One of our biggest concerns with the ban is that the ban doesn't allow the authorities to go in to register pet cats. We have seen year on year, we've seen a clear decline in the number of abandoned dogs. And that's clearly because of very good and stringent microchipping and licensing rules for dogs. And we desperately need the same for cats because cats are being abandoned for years and this number is not coming down. Maybe a slight change with CCTVs being up recently, but you go into any estate where 100% of the community cats have been sterilized, and that has happened in a fair number of areas. Mm-hmm. You go in there 6 months later and there are unsterilized non-ear-tipped cats back again. You have caregivers who are spending a lot of resources going in there trying to sterilize these animals, welfare groups as well doing this work. But we're constantly chasing our tails because people are breeding cats at home and they can abandon whenever they like because you can't trace the ownership back to them.
Explain for me a little bit, how does the ban directly affect that? So let's say the government decided to lift the ban tomorrow. How does that strengthen your ability to do what's needed as far as the reading and all this is involved?
So it shouldn't just be lifting the ban, because if you just lift the ban, full stop, you've not really achieved actually much beyond having people now not feel so concerned every day, which is a good outcome as well in itself. But the lifting of the ban has to be tied in with a registration scheme for cat owners so that you can microchip and register every cat to an owner.
Okay.
So you can trace in the event where cats, for example, get abandoned, you can trace it back to who had the cats. And also then you can start looking at the people who are keeping cats in HDB, asking them to do it responsibly. Because we do agree, we don't just want the ban to be lifted. We don't just want people to be keeping cats or even dogs and any other species without regard for the community. That's not the right way to go about this. If you're going to keep a pet, you have to be responsible. But now it's difficult to have that responsibility imposed onto the cat owners because they're not even allowed to keep cats.
Excellent point. Excellent. Yeah. So, Kelvin, what do you think it's realistic though for us to aspire to a regime where all cats are microchipped, all cats are registered to owners, and in the end have sort of parity between cats and dogs?
Licensing for dogs, right? It's for traceability where, you know, let's say a disease happens. And I think, like any licensing system, I think traceability is very important. And I think this is something we definitely could review.
So that's a great point. As it stands, there is, as I suspect, still confusion as to why the ban still exists. Hopefully, as time passes, indeed, we are able to lift it on the one hand, but also strengthen the requirements of ownership of cats as well. But let's take overall sort of step back, and if we could just crystal ball gaze a little bit. Obviously, over the last 5 years or more, there's been quite a strengthening of voices in terms of pet and animal welfare, thanks to many people out there. Where do you think we are at? You know, obviously, there has been some improvement. Mm-hmm. Has there been, firstly, improvement in Singaporeans' own social responsibility and ability to do what's right? And in parallel with that, where do you see the ideal as we close off our discussion? Ideal situation for a country like Singapore is quite unique. I mean, it's a bit like a city like New York, but people do want to own pets. What is a nice balance in terms of regulation versus NGOs versus responsibility? Jay Powell, you first maybe.
So it's a very clear trend in a positive direction is what we are seeing. If you rewind 10, 20 years ago, if you look at a simple example of the number of people who had adopted or who were interested to adopt, I think that number has changed. A lot more people are aware now that there are animals in shelters who need homes. And if you want to get a pet, a good option would be to adopt one instead of buying. So we're seeing a clear move in that direction. If you look at Project Adore as well, I mean, it's a good example. We started off talking about that project here. The number of people taking up Singapore Specials and being very proud that they are an owner of a street dog. I think that's beautiful and fantastic to see. If you talk about welfare standards as well, I think people are definitely more aware that when you keep a pet, it cannot just be, you know, for your convenience. You put an animal in a cage, you just just, you know, feed it and water it and that's good enough. No, I think there are a lot more people who realize that, number one, a pet's a lifetime commitment. Mm-hmm. If I keep an animal, I'm going to do everything I can to keep the animal until its end, and I'm going to give it as good a life as I can. So I think we are moving in a very good direction. I'm very happy to see where we're heading. And I think we need to continue, of course, the awareness and education efforts to move us further along there. In terms of your second part of your question, I think we do have a nice balance between education, awareness versus regulation and enforcement. Nobody wants a situation where you have too much regulation. Uh-huh. That's not good for the people. It's not good for those of us who are running the systems. But of course, you must have some. You must have some rules that people have to abide by, especially on things that you cannot compromise on, like animal welfare. Uh-huh. Those things have to be strictly enforced. But in terms of the education and awareness, I think that's always been a part of our animal welfare ecosystem in Singapore. And I think moving forward, we need to continue realizing that that's actually one of the best ways you can make changes, because a lot of the positive outcomes we are seeing today is a result of a large group of people who have learned a better way of doing things, who have been made aware of animal welfare in Singapore. So I think we have to keep doing that moving forward.
And Kelvin, from your perspective, as you deal with owners a lot as well, what's your take on where we are?
First, we can talk about two different groups. You know, firstly, is the pet owners. Definitely, I think whether you are a current pet owner or you are looking to be a pet owner, you know, increased awareness of animal welfare. And I mean, if you are looking to getting a new pet, you know, perhaps you can adopt instead of buying pets and work with animal welfare groups. And indeed, we actually have been working with animal welfare groups like SPCA to rehome animals, dogs and cats, through different programs like the Trap, Neuter, Release, Manage program. And while on the other end of the spectrum, you have people that who do not accept animals, you know, as much. The vision is that, you know, increasingly we want them to accept that animals are actually part of our urban ecosystem. You know, whether it's a community animal.
I like to think so too. Yeah, yeah. As someone, as I say, who I have a dog, and sometimes I wish I could put him on the MRT as well to go from point A to point B. Just dedicate one car in the MRT for dogs, if you could, please. But anyway, as I sort of end this, and we've been talking about street dogs. Mm-hmm. One question which has always bugged me as well is there a equilibrium or best point to be where it comes to stray or mongrel dogs and cats that are breeding outside of registered outlets? In that, yes, I hope that the population of street dogs is declining over time. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can, J-Pa, give me a sense of that. But where is a realistic endpoint for a country like Singapore in terms of stray dogs and cats? What is feeding population growth, and what is the realistic sort of endpoint in managing the growth of both cats and dogs?
I think most of us accept that the life of a street animal is not ideal for the animal. In a best case scenario, if you have everything going right and all the resources, you would hope to have some of all these animals actually into good and loving homes. We see plenty of street dogs and cats getting into accidents. We run a rescue service at the SPCA, so we see these animals when the worst happens to them. Some animals get into fights with each other, they get wounds, then they turn into maggot wounds, and they sometimes die a slow, painful death. And some of them are susceptible to abuse as well. So the life is a precarious one on the street. So for years, what the animal welfare groups have been doing is, with a lot of rescuers on the ground, is to sterilize these animals, right? If you sterilize them, the population will decline naturally. I think we are seeing with the cat side in certain areas, stabilization and reduction in population because of the efforts over many years. With the dogs, of course, with the introduction of the nationwide dog Trap, Neuter, Release, Manage program launched in 2018, funded by the government, and I think they're working with multiple animal welfare partners, including the SPCA. We hope to significantly bring down the street dog population as well, humanely through sterilization and rehoming.
Kelvin, to make the question start, is it realistic for anybody to aspire, even if you may never get there, to 0% populations of stray cats and dogs?
Well, I guess we aspire, you know, towards the vision that, you know, these animals are part of our ecosystem. So as much as possible, you know, as J-Pa has said, we try to find permanent living homes, because, you know, we don't want them to be exposed to inclement weather, you know, no food, that sort of thing. So Project Adore is sort of an adjunct to TDNRM.
Yeah, I mean, in the best case scenario, if you just project, if all street dogs and cats are eventually home, there will come a time where you will have none left. Or is that just a bit too naive, a mathematical calculation? I don't know. But indeed, I'm glad at least you guys think that we are on the right track. Jaipal and Kelvin, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast of Heart of the Matter.
Thank you
so much. For all of you out there, Heart of the Matter is available on the CNA website and app under the podcast tab, or you can subscribe to us on Spotify or iTunes. So stay tuned and don't miss an episode. Till next week, I'm Jamie Ho. Behind me, my team, Lin Su Ling, Crispina Robert, and Erin Low. Thank you, guys.
Thanks. You.